Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group, a leading provider of commercial real estate intelligence. I'm super excited to say we have a special guest on with us today, Ryan Severino. Ryan serves as Chief Economist and Head of Research at Bentall Green Oak, where he focuses on global and regional economic research, analysis, and commentary, as well as supporting BGO's investment and portfolio management teams through property market forecasting. He has more than 25 years of economics, real estate, and investment research experience. He holds a master's degree from Columbia and a bachelor's degree from Georgetown. He's also a CFA Institute charter holder. Ryan, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So Ryan, how about you tell our listeners what your team looks like and how you guys might go about some of that economic modeling scenario analysis?
So it's interesting. I think of, you know, my direct team, there are a handful of us who really focus on what you might traditionally consider economics and research, thinking about and forecasting the macro economy, thinking about and analyzing real estate markets. And then we work hand in hand with the data science team, which is overseen by our chief data scientist, who's a close colleague of mine. That's where we have a number of people who are really starting to think. And they have been, I probably shouldn't discount that too much. It's now going on 6 years that we've been really working on this, thinking outside the box in terms of not just the data sets, but how useful the data sets are. I think there's this, I'll call it understanding to be polite. There's this understanding in the real estate industry that the data is not very good and can't really use it for forecasting. And so a lot of the cutting edge techniques don't make a lot of sense. And our data science team has, maybe literally, but at least metaphorically said, you know, hold our beer. And they've gone out and consistently demonstrated that that's not true, that if you are willing to put significant resources behind this effort, that variables like rent are actually much more forecastable with pretty good accuracy than I think the average person in our industry perceives it to be. And so I'm bringing a little more of the top-down approach to this. But again, even they're pushing the envelope in terms of using, you know, big data and artificial intelligence. They're bringing it from a little more from the bottom-up granularity. And really where we kind of synthesize those two things together is where, you know, sort of my direct team matches up with the data science team and how those things are not disconnected, how we do splice them together into a coherent, cohesive worldview of, you know, whatever markets we happen to be thinking about.
I'm wondering if you could share a little bit more about how some of the work that you're doing directly influence some of BGO's investment decisions. And if you can share, I guess we'd love to know maybe an example of one of your insights translating into a particular strategy.
One of the nice things about BGO is that we don't just pay lip service to this sort of thing. It's not just, I want to be careful. I don't want to make it sound like I'm casting aspersions at anyone, but this isn't a situation where we hired one data scientist and they're running models locally on a computer or even on a local server. And they're saying a few things. And then they say, look, we have a data science team, right? This is a very serious effort with quantities of data that I probably can't even quantify anymore. Literally hundreds of billions, trillions of data points, models that literally have to run on a data center using thousands of GPUs running simultaneously. And they still take multiple days to run. And I say that because this is a firm that has bought into this. This is not a firm that is just checking a box, paying lip service to tell clients and prospects, oh, we do data science. And so it is increasingly becoming a more fundamental part of how the investments process works. So just for example, if there's a deal that's going to be brought before investment committee, then there is a score that comes from the data science team that says, this is what we think about this market. This is how it ranks. There's a forecasted rent growth vector that they use for underwriting purposes. So again, this is not just a window dressing exercise. This is increasingly becoming a fundamental part of how we go about the process. And then ultimately, I think it will become, I don't want to say completely pervasive, but We're increasingly starting to use it in terms of how the asset management team manages assets that are already on our balance sheet. We're starting to think about using it. The chief data scientist and I have been kicking around ideas and some models and how we can use it in more of a traditional portfolio management context. I think a really good case study of this is probably if you go back, let's call it 4 or 5 years ago, I'll ballpark it a little bit. The models were saying it would be a really good idea to go out and invest in Las Vegas industrial. And pretty much everybody hated Las Vegas industrial at the time, including the major third-party prognosticators that you can license forecasts from. But we had good confidence in the models and we went out. And I think I might get the number wrong on this, so I'll qualify this. But the last time I think I got an update, the deal has outperformed underwriting by cumulatively like 45, 50% in terms of rent growth, something like that. And so that's an instance where the average person who's been involved in real estate, especially in industrial, would look at that and they wouldn't have touched Las Vegas industrial with a billion foot pole, but the model had really good confidence in it that the model nailed it. The actual rent that we've realized has been stronger even than the underwriting said it was likely to be. So I think that's a really good example of how we try to use this to be contrarian, right? We're not trying to be transgressive or subversive, but we're really trying to find opportunities that other people think aren't opportunities. And I would say on the flip side, Matt Servino, who's one of our portfolio managers, I feel like I've said this in the past, but I want to give him credit for saying it most recently. Sometimes the best deal is the one you don't do. And so we also utilize it to basically avoid fool's gold and say, oh, here's a market that everybody loves, but maybe it's not going to be that great. That's something else that I feel like the model really helps us do so that we don't even get to the pipeline or investment committee stage. We can kind of head that off at the pass.
So I think that those sounded like a few success stories with this strategy, but are there any particular challenges with aligning some of your research with those investment decisions?
I'd say, honestly, the biggest challenge is that the technology is just so new, especially to people who, and I'm sure both of you understand this as well as I do, this has largely been a relationship business for the entirety of its history, the last 40 to 50 years. And so here come the Uber nerds with their fancy models and data centers and math, and they're going to come in and they're going to tell us, you know, I feel like we're the equivalent of Moneyball 25 years ago, where we're like, we've got the data and analytics. Like, I don't need to go scout that guy in the farm system. Like, I already know looking at the data. And so again, we have good buy-in from management, but I will be honest and say like there's a learning curve for people with this. And it can be difficult to understand models that are just this sophisticated. They frequently will seem like black boxes to people who don't traffic in multivariable calculus and linear algebra on a weekly basis the way that I do and the way that the data science team does. And so I'd say that is probably the biggest challenge, like demonstrating to people that there is another approach to this that's not just, well, we have a good relationship and we know this market really well, so this is probably a good place to do a deal. We're not trying to lose that completely, but I think in an asset class like this, it's a private market, it's somewhat illiquid. There's that art part of it that they're bringing to the table. Increasingly, we're trying to bring the science part of it to the table. And that's where, again, I think it's been discounted. People have said, you can't do this. And we look at it and think, we can actually do this. And so there's a little bit of education of how some of this stuff works and getting people comfortable with it. And I think we've made a lot of progress there, but I think there's still probably a little ways to go with just because it is so new to an industry that hasn't really relied on data and analytics that intensely for most of its history.
Ryan, when you're not living in data or working and refining models, I know you spend a lot of time with your clients and giving presentations, and we're huge fans of your newsletter, The Chief Economist.
Oh, thanks.
So what inspires you to find topics to discuss and to explain? I suspect it's not a model output, but can you tell us a little bit about how you identify what you should be focusing on and what you should be diving into further?
I think I'm sort of blessed and cursed with maybe being the most curious person on the planet. I'm just like, I always want to be learning something. And so my kids make fun of me all the time because, you know, if they come home and I'm watching TV, they're like, oh, dad's watching another documentary, blah, blah, blah. It's funny. I was watching the documentary on the Olympic basketball tournament last year. My younger one came downstairs and said, oh, you're actually not watching a documentary. You're watching basketball. I said, no, it's a documentary about basketball. And she just had this look on her face, like so defeated, like, oh, he's watching another documentary. But I've always been a very naturally curious person. And so what I'm frequently doing is reading about things that seemingly have nothing to do with economics and real estate, but somehow I always find ways to make interesting connections. To use an analogy for anyone out there who's studied like portfolio theory, I look at it as like mosaic theory, right? There are a lot of interesting things that are probably more connected than you think. And I do have the ability now with big data sets and machine learning to start to think about ways to connect these in interesting ways that I couldn't have done 5, 10, 15 years ago. Certainly not when I was in graduate school 24, 25-ish years ago. And so I'm constantly thinking about and trying to learn about all of these things that I think are relevant, that have a connection that maybe the average person just isn't thinking about or doesn't want to think about or isn't interested in. It's funny, somebody asked me the other day what other economists I pay attention to. And I said, with all due respect, I try not to pay attention to them because I like having my own independent view. I build my own models. I run my own models. I do my own research. I have my own thoughts on this. After the fact, I might look to see what some other people have said, almost just a, like an interesting comparison. But I really try not to do that in advance because I've read enough about psychology and taken enough psychology classes to know how it works. That stuff seeps into your subconscious, whether you want it to or not. And I like having my own ideas. I certainly don't want to go around co-opting anybody else's ideas. And so I'm constantly reading about sociology, about political theory, about technology, about demographics, almost anything that I think can be studied and quantified. I'm trying to read about that on some level. I don't always go super deep on any of those individual topics if I don't think there's really a there. But I've been able to come up with some surprising things over the years where I think that's one of the reasons why I've probably come to some contrarian points of view that have proven themselves pretty well over the last 10 to 15 years when other people haven't, because I'm just like such a uber geek that I feel like I should always be learning and reading and trying to synthesize this stuff. Like I said, the always watching documentaries, or my wife also makes fun of me because she knows that I almost never read fiction. She's like, oh yeah, there you are, like reading another periodical or an academic journal or a nonfiction book, because she knows that it's just, if I'm going to read, I try to learn something. And so I'm almost never, and I don't want to make it sound like I'm devoid of fun, but I do like to spend my time learning about things. I genuinely enjoy it. And I think that's helped me really start to use kind of that mosaic framework to piece disparate pieces of a puzzle together. Whereas I don't think a lot of people are that interested in some of the outlying pieces. They probably just tend to try to focus on the middle of the puzzle most of the time.
So I do want to get your opinion on a few things. What is your read on the current macroeconomic environment? And is there a particular indicator you're watching super closely right now?
I'm still optimistic, at least I hate to say cautiously optimistic because everybody hedges with that. But I've been, for me, it's been a positive, but I think double-edged sword for people who do the kind of things that I do as a vocation is being quoted. And one of the good things about, I shouldn't open my mouth, the universe listens when I say stuff like this, but one of the really good things about being right a lot more than I've been wrong over the course of my career is I can go back and point to things. And so I've been saying, at least since 2021, I couldn't find any instance earlier than that, but that I didn't think that we were headed for a recession, that I didn't think it was inevitable, that I thought everyone was getting it wrong because they were getting overexcited about the Fed raising rates. And I think some of it was because, again, I think they were looking at outdated models and ways of thinking at the world. And I'm over here with my different techniques and different data sources and thinking about the world differently. And the main thing that I saw that made me think that we weren't going to end up in a recession, which sounds like a negative, but actually ended up being a positive, was that we have a massive labor shortage in the US right now. It's very structural, demographics-based labor shortage. You have baby boomers exiting the workforce every day. Subsequent generations are not big enough to backfill that, certainly not relative to an expanding economy. And so to me, the rubber meets the road with the labor market. And I wasn't seeing deterioration in the labor market. I'm still not seeing deterioration in the labor market. And that, until I see that, I'm still going to feel relatively confident about where the economy is going. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some cracks in the armor here and there. And that's always been the case. But I think when you go through a period like this, where we've been at or near the lowest unemployment rate in half a century, it's a little bit easier to pick on some of the blemishes that come along. The one that I've been thinking about lately, and certainly the press has been talking about it, has been the fortunes of young college graduates, 22 to call it 27-year-olds, because their unemployment rate relative to the overall unemployment rate is the highest in history. It's certainly the highest it's been during what I would call such a tight labor market environment. And so that's something that I think about because, not because I think their careers are doomed, I don't want to be scaremongering about this, but it shows something that I think has been, it gets hidden in big aggregate data, which is there are always supply and demand mismatches in the labor market. And sometimes they're not as easy to see. Sometimes with this, they are relatively easy to see. And I think one of the maybe, sort of double-edged sword, if not unfortunate, things that have come about in the last 10 to 15 years for a variety of reasons is this idea that getting an education is just this perfunctory thing you do to go get a job and have a career. You're basically the antithesis of me, right? You don't think about education just because you like learning and you want to know things. You think about it explicitly for a career. When that aligns really well with the demand in the labor market, as it has for people in technology for the last 10-ish years, let's call it, it's great. But when that misaligns and you've just been so single-mindedly focused on being so career-oriented, then it becomes a problem, which is why you're seeing elevated unemployment rates for young college graduates in computer science and computer engineering. So it's like the music stopped and not enough people have chairs at this point. And so I don't think that is enough to cause widespread damage in the economy and the labor market, but I objectively find it interesting. And I'm starting to think through, what do we think are the ramifications of this for the macro economy, for the real estate market, for individual markets in the US and around the world? Because this is not just a phenomenon that you see in the United States, in the United Kingdom, and in Europe. Some not identical because they're not as technology focused as we are in the US, but you've certainly seen some echoes of what's going on here. So that's the thing that I always really think about. The rubber meets the road with the labor market. GDP can lie to you. Interest rates can be maybe not as tweaked to the market as they should be. Inflation can be manipulated by a whole bunch of things happening at the same time. But the labor market is about as good of an indicator. It generally doesn't lie. If the labor market is deteriorating, it's usually a pretty good sign for something not going well.
So Ryan, one of the things you predicted for 2025 was that it'd be a brighter year for CRE. Do you mind elaborating on that and telling us if you think that your opinion has changed at all now that we're halfway through?
Yeah, no, I was just thinking sentiment would certainly improve relative to the last few years. Transaction volume might actually be up a little bit. I didn't think pricing would start to stabilize. But the main thing I thought was that returns would continue to accelerate. And we've really seen that. Admittedly, we just hit the midpoint of the year, so we only really have about one good quarter of data. So I don't want to overstate this too much. But I think the thing that makes me heartened about this, even with some uncertainty lurking out there because of trade policy, even fiscal policy to a certain extent, is that real estate is an incredibly cyclical asset class and an incredibly cyclical business. It doesn't follow a random walk the way the equity markets, public equity markets do, or the public fixed income markets can sometimes. And so when I see things start to stabilize and turn, I feel pretty good about where things are going. Now, it doesn't mean it has to be a straight line improvement. There can still be some fluctuation and ups and downs. And I do think some of the policy framework that we're now dealing with is probably slowing things down a little bit. But I don't see any of that being enough to dislodge this. The analogy that I've used in my writing is that it's more akin to a speed bump, not a roadblock. It's probably slowed that improvement down, but I don't think it's been enough to derail anything. I still think there's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines that wants to be invested. I think it's been a tough environment from when the Fed started raising rates up until even last year, where we really started to see things turning around. I still feel optimistic about where things are going in the medium term, but I do think we've had a little bit of a speed bump with some of the policy uncertainty that we've been contending with over the first couple quarters of the year.
If you remember, do you have any contrarian takes in that outlook that maybe other folks weren't thinking of?
You know, I still think interest rate declines are going to surprise people because I do think that there is a slowing in the economy. GDP growth will probably be half of what it was last year. Job growth has been positive, but has been slowing down over time. And also because I think inflation has decelerated notably. And even with some of this uncertainty that we've been dealing with, you've seen inflation continue to decelerate. Now, I do think there are probably some latent inflationary pressures that will come through because of trade policy, but marginal. I don't want to overstate it. Nothing like we went through during the pandemic. And I think the Fed is smart enough to see through that because if they get to a point where they're balancing potentially greater deceleration, if not deterioration in the labor market, against marginally higher one-time inflation, I think they're going to see through that. Now, I want to be clear about this. It's not that I think they're going to cut 5, 6, 7, 8 times, but between the short end of the curve and the long end of the curve, it still feels like there's more downside risk, I think, over the next 6 months, balance of the year in the labor market than there probably is on the price stability side, on the inflation side. And I say that as someone who expects, relative to this kind of non-elevated tariff baseline, that we would probably be in what continues to be a decelerating environment. So I think there's probably a marginal increase relative to that non-tariff baseline world. But I still think the Fed is probably smart enough to see through that. And I think if inflation doesn't really move that dramatically, I think the Treasury market will also be smart enough to see through that as well.
So in your Q2 CRE and U.S. economic outlook, you did introduce an augmented base case model for the U.S. economy. Do you want to walk us through that? Maybe tell us if there are any unconventional components to it?
Yeah, so I will be honest with you. This was born just out of sheer frustration and exhaustion. And I say that, like, people who know me, like, I'm not a political person, right? So don't read anything, some latent political commentary into this. But just as someone who's responsible for building and running and updating the models, I was just spending a lot of time every time the administration just changed its mind on trade policy, then having to go back into the model and change what was in there and then see what the output was. So it's Liberation Day and these tariffs are at really high rates, and then I'm running the model. And then it's, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to do this other thing. And then we have carve-outs for these certain things, but then these carve-outs are changing, and now we're re-implementing higher tariff rates than we said that we were going to. And it was just, I was spending a lot of time just updating that part of a model and just having to rerun it. And I thought, I just want to get to the chase, right? For better or worse, like, I just want to know where we ended up. And I thought, the problem with this is it's not a typical economics econometrics problem where you take some data and you build a model and produce a forecast and see what it looks like. To me, this looked more like a behavioral science, behavioral economics problem. And so what I did was I actually built a machine learning model, but I trained it on policy decisions from the first administration and then what we've gotten over the first 5, 6 months or so. Because I, again, it's not a traditional take this data, build a regression-based model and spit out some output. And so I had the model go back and just look at executive orders, policy decisions, things like that, and make an assessment of where I just wanted one, right? I wanted the effective tariff rate, which is really what's important for this. I wanted to know about where it would end up. And so I used what I learned in behavioral economics class to actually build a machine learning model. And so I had to train the model on a bunch of stuff, and then the model ran. The model's ultimate conclusion was that we were going to end up in an elevated tariff environment relative to where we were in March before Liberation Day, and certainly relative to where we were in January before we started to change trade policy. And the way that I explained it to people was, I don't need the model to nail that effective tariff rate down to the basis point. It just needed to get me in the ballpark. And as long as it gets me in the ballpark, then I can say some pretty definitive things about where I think the economy is going to go, because that part of the model will be pretty settled. And I'm going to knock wood. I'm trying not to take a premature victory lap on this. But even in the decisions, the agreements that have been reached thus far, tariffs are a part of that. The agreement with the United Kingdom, tariffs are a part of that. The agreement with Vietnam, tariffs, elevated tariffs are a part of that. The framework with China, which I don't know exactly where it's going yet, elevated tariffs are a part of that. It seems like even when they can actually reach an agreement, elevated tariffs are still on the table. So it's a little early to be grading papers, if you will, I say as someone who also moonlights as a professor. As I'm grading the paper and going through it, so far, I got to say that the model did a pretty good job. And the model was supremely confident in this. The model said, look, it doesn't matter if they win in court or not. They're going to keep finding ways, either because Congress has already said they could, or they're going to get creative legislatively to keep pushing this. And again, who knows? The world's an unpredictable place. But the fact that those agreements that have been in place to date still have that component to it makes me think the model pretty much nailed it. I mean, who knows, right? We could end up in some bizarre old world where that's not true. But I didn't think that was the case, but I felt better making that assertion once the model was so confident that trade policy would ultimately end up in a place where tariffs are elevated relative to March levels and January levels.
Were there any scenarios that you either considered or that the model considered that would put us in a different position around trade policy and where rather than just having a level, like essentially a slight step up, that it actually would be a more, I would say, jarring situation?
So the model did look at the possibility that we could end up in a very elevated tariff scenario because now the model has a data point that says, oh, we did announce really high tariffs in, at the beginning of April. So I look at it, I think of it like a probabilistic assessment. The model's not saying that that's a 0% probability, but it doesn't think that it's a very likely outcome. The same way it doesn't think going, I would never tell you, like there are no guarantees ever in economics. So I would never say we definitely can't go back to a pre-April baseline, but it's not a very high probability outcome is the most diplomatic way I can say that. And so I think there's a range of possibilities, but the model thinks that ultimately we're going to end up with more agreements at elevated tariff rates and that we're going to end up in an environment not dissimilar from where the effective tariff rate is about now. But again, I don't need that to be right down to the basis point. I just need it to be right enough that as an input to the model, it doesn't create a lot of noise in the ultimate output. It doesn't add a lot of uncertainty to what my main macro model is ultimately producing for the economy.
Moving from macro to CRE markets, how do you assess the current state of CRE, whether that's repricing, you can look at the financing space and debt maturities, or overall kind of transaction volume?
It's interesting because I think if you look on the fundamental side, the market's held up pretty well. And if you're a relatively new entrant to commercial real estate, you might think, what's he talking about? Hasn't he noticed the construction in industrial and you know apartments over the last few years or so? And I would say, look, if you look at the asset class in aggregate, we just don't build as much as we used to. Once upon a time, even before my day in this industry, it was really the supply side that knocked commercial real estate off track. The S&L crisis of the 1980s into the 1990s is exhibit A for that. Even during the dot-com boom and bust, it wasn't as widespread, but in certain markets, we just got over our skis on development. Certainly, the global financial crisis was predicated on excess housing, which feels laughable to say right now.
And we've overcorrected, but yeah.
I want to be careful, right? I'm not laughing at anyone who's out there struggling. As somebody who spent a lot of the last 10 to 15 years telling people that millennials were going to become homeowners and not live in urban areas, renting apartments and taking their bicycles and or public transportation to their green open plan offices sort of thing, to the point where I once got booed at a conference for saying that, if you can believe it. I look at that world and think, yeah, we did build some stuff over the last 4 or 5 years in certain property types, in certain markets. But if you contrast that with history, we don't actually build all that much. And so more of the variation in terms of how the fundamental side behaves tends to come from the demand side these days more than the buy side, or at least more of the variation, the standard deviation comes from that side of it. And so I look at the demand side, it's held up pretty well. It's not immune to uncertainty and what's been going on, but it's definitely stabilizing and mounting a recovery. And so on the whole, aside from maybe office, which is its own idiosyncratic thing, I feel pretty good about where space market fundamentals are. Income returns have held up incredibly well under really exigent circumstances for the last 4 to 5 years. And that, to me, is what acquits the fundamental side of this. It's really been on the capital market side, on the appreciation side, where real estate has gotten punched in the mouth a little bit. And that's where, you know, fingers crossed, I think we're seeing, as I said, it's a cyclical industry where I think it's not in the same positive place that the fundamental side is, but there has definitely been progress made there over the last 6 to 12 months. Total returns are still largely swinging back to positive because of that income return, but appreciation returns have gotten a lot less negative over the last few quarters. And, you know, you can always make the argument that there's some rift between what's trading and appraised values. And so it might be a little bit of smoke and mirrors going on there. But again, I just think about the medium to long-term trajectory and think unless something really random, idiosyncratic happens, that should persist. And so I feel better about the fundamental side than I do about the capital market side at this juncture. But I do think both of them are generally trending in the right direction. But if I'm being honest and fair about it, I do think capital markets is lagging a little bit. But some of that's just because it got hit harder. It had a bigger but it had a bigger hole to climb out of than the space market fundamentals side of commercial real estate did.
And if you had to give a quick rundown across the sectors and property types in terms of what you think is most attractive to least attractive, how would you stack them up?
So I'll be honest and say my view on this is going to differ probably a little bit from BGO's house view. So I just want, and I'll highlight that when I get to it. I still think housing is in a good spot. We are just all evidence in certain markets over the last 5 years, notwithstanding, we are structurally undersupplied on housing. I still think there are tremendous opportunities in we broadly play in the for rent side, but even on the for sale side, there's just not enough inventory there. So I'm still pretty bullish on housing. The part where I'd probably deviate the most from the firm is I've been a champion of retail for the last 15 years in a way that maybe didn't get me booed quite telling people that millennials weren't going to live in apartments in urban areas forever did. But it took a while for me to convince people. Even in the couple of years that I've been at BGO, it's funny. I'm definitely not afraid to speak my mind when I have conviction in something. Even one of our CEOs, John Carfield, said probably a quarter or so ago, when we were talking about retail, he said, I'm not sure I'm totally on board with Ryan's way of thinking just yet, but he's convincing me of this. And so I was like, wow. I was like, that is a lot coming from someone like that. And so I think retail has been tarred and feathered unnecessarily for the last 10 to 15 years. And I still think industrial has a good role to play in this. And I think it's going to be hard to replicate the performance that we went through leading into and through the pandemic. And even office. Office is clearly the laggard of the major property types. But just like I wasn't willing to throw the baby out with the, I hate that expression, I shouldn't use it, but since I said it anyway, the baby out with the bathwater for retail, I'm certainly not willing to do that for office. I won't go as so far as to say, you know, everything has a price, but I do think people are probably going to make mistakes about the office market the same way they made mistakes about the retail market over the last 10 to 15 years. There will certainly be good opportunities there over time. I think it's probably a little bit early in that game, and I think you're really going to have to do your homework on those deals. And so overall, the sector probably lags behind. But I hate to write off one of the four major food groups. That feels like a very irresponsible thing to do right now.
Do you think that over the last 25 years, you've been doing economic forecasts and essentially crunching a lot of data to ultimately inform your view on what it means for the future? What have you learned about the limitations and the possibilities of economic prediction?
I think the one thing that I've really learned with this age of big data centers, that kind of just massive compute power, is that there's a lot of information in data that can be hard to find. But just because it's hard to find doesn't mean it's not actually there. And what I find really interesting about that is I tend to, especially given my role, I do tend to think like very big picture what's going on in the world, but it's not divorced from what's going on in a more micro level. And I think I look at the data and I think, okay, it's not a perfect crystal ball. I don't ever want to put it out there that like this is a crystal ball and everything's going to go exactly according to plan. But the thing that has really impressed me about it is that you can get very granular with data in a way that I think people thought once upon a time, oh, you can only look at this at the aggregate level because real estate data is so dirty and noisy and it's got a bunch of mistakes in it. And so I think there are probably more limitations at the aggregate property type than there are actually somewhat ironically are at the micro level. You know, we look at it and we see massive differentiation. Just to give an example, one of the standards in the industry, we see massive differentiation by submarket performance, especially when we build our models and look over, say, the next 5 years or so. Even within metros sometimes, right? You think, oh, a lot of this is colored by the metro. And it is. I don't want to understate the importance of the metro, but there are some markets where the difference between what we think could be a really good performing submarket and a really lagging performing submarket, they're not that far away from each other geographically. Economically, they're miles away, as you might imagine, given where we think the performance is going. But geographically, like sometimes they're literally adjacent to each other in a market in a metro area. And so I think a lot of the limitations end up being because application can be challenging. And if you're just used to only thinking about data in one dimension, I just grossly simplify this macro versus micro. then yeah, then you will miss a lot of the information and it will just look like noise. But so that's where I think the data can close one door, but actually open maybe another more useful door at the same time. That's where I actually, you know, I'll look for the silver lining in this. It's why I'm like such a geek and so curious about so many things, right? What can I possibly, I guess the way I think about it is, if I get to a point where the data can only get me so far the way to something, the question that I try to answer is, what is still out there that can get me a little further to a, maybe not a like perfect information, but more complete information? And when I have a reasonable confidence that I've exhausted that I've gotten to that point, then I'll stop, because then there's no, the marginal benefit, I'm going to sound like an economist at this point, but the marginal benefit massively exceeds the marginal cost of my time to go looking for it. But if I still think there's a benefit there, then I will go looking for that. And I will try to find whatever marginal benefit that I think can be obtained without excess marginal cost. And so that's how I think about the data. It will definitely close the door in your face sometimes, but usually when it does, if you look around, you'll see that there's another door waiting for you to open. And that's where I come back to this like mosaic idea. I don't think a lot of people go looking for those other doors when they feel like the door in front of them is closed.
So Ryan, you mentioned that you moonlight also as a professor, both at Columbia GSAP, which I happen to be an alum of, but I didn't take your class, regrettably. And at NYU Shack. So how about you tell us a little about those courses, maybe what you enjoy about them, what you've learned. And then I know you offered up in your prep call that this is a particularly difficult environment for folks trying to break into this industry. And I know that might be hard news to deliver to some of your students, but maybe if you could tell us a little about what you're thinking there.
Yeah, so it's funny. I genuinely love what I do, but if you believe in the multiverse sort of thing, there are thousands of multiverses out there where I'm just like a full-time tenured professor somewhere. Because if I weren't doing this, that's probably what I would reasonably doing. I've always liked teaching from the time I was, even in high school as a tutor, through graduate school where I was a graduate teaching assistant for certain classes. I've always just genuinely enjoyed it. All joking aside, like I do come from a very working blue collar background, and I was only able to obtain the education that I was able to obtain because I had really great teachers, both in academic settings and professional settings. And because just to be completely honest, like somebody else donated money for scholarships and fellowships so I could attend undergraduate and graduate school. And I'm not ashamed to admit that. I've always looked to pay that forward to somebody. I can't pay those things back necessarily. I guess I could teach my teachers about some things every now and then, but I can't pay back whoever donated the money for my scholarships and fellowships. So I always try to pay them that forward to someone else so that they can go get an education, but also pay the teaching forward to someone else, right? I think teaching in society has gotten a really bad rap, especially these days. I think teachers are totally undervalued in society from the preschool level all the way through the graduate level. I think society functions because somebody's teaching the next generation. And I thought, I can't pay those favors back to the people who gave them to me. I would love to pay that forward to someone else. And so even once I realized that I wasn't going to write a dissertation and move to Tokyo for 12 to 24 months and risk my relationship with my now wife, I still wanted to teach. And so I ultimately found my way into doing that. And I think I've been fortunate over the 16 years that I've been teaching to teach a variety of classes. I've taught portfolio management class. I've taught urban economics class. A couple times when needed, I've even taught microecon. I've taught macroecon. I've taught a couple econometrics a couple times. I think the thing that I bring to the table, if I have any competitive advantage versus hardcore tenured professor, is that I am living, breathing this stuff day-to-day basis. And so I can tell you what the textbook on Markowitz portfolio theory says, and then I can tell you how it actually works for real estate portfolios in the real world. I can tell you what an urban economics textbook says about central place theory, but I can show you how that actually has impacted metropolitan areas around the world. And so I think the students really like that I do bring that practical perspective that, I mean, I can be an Uber geek, right? Because I had to suffer through all the math and the coding and the econometrics and economic theory, but I realize that there's more to it than that. And that's where I like to take what I've learned in the real world over almost, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but the almost three decades that I've now been working in the real world, and really marrying those things together in a way that doesn't discount one or the other, but synthesizes it in a way that shows students the power of these subjects, but also shows them the practical limitations and how you can work around those things and think through those things. Again, it goes back to the door analogy. Just because the door gets closed for some of this stuff doesn't mean you can't open other doors and use the theory and the techniques in other ways. In terms of how it's impacted my students, again, I can tell you firsthand, like I have seen this, that dynamic that I was talking about earlier, young college graduates struggling relative to the overall labor market. I know it's been tough for them. And I really care about that, not just as their teacher, as an educator, but I think about the future of industry, right? If we're not bringing people on board to learn these things, it's interesting because as human beings, I think the pandemic really taught us, we really evolved to be machines who learn best adjacent to other people, right? It's why the best model for learning is still being in a physical classroom with the teacher and the other students around you. Same thing in the working world. And I want to be careful about this because I think there are benefits to work from home at least part of the time. But there are benefits to being in a physical space adjacent to other people and the conversations and the projects you work on and the information transfer. Even just going to networking events and happy hours and things that seem mundane, there are lots of benefits to that. It's why industry does agglomerate, right? People don't love being in New York or San Francisco or Silicon Valley because it's super cheap. They're willing to pay prices to be there because the benefits outweigh the costs. And so I think even if this is more of a speed bump than a roadblock, we as an industry really have a responsibility to think about that next generation, right? Because if we're not training that next generation to be the leaders of the future, then at some point there's going to be a problem. There's going to be a disconnect. Who knows, right? Maybe in 80 years, we're all blithely plugged into the matrix and we're all like focused on being like Keanu ninjas or whatever. But until we get to that point, even with this technology as great as it is, we're still going to need people. I mean, even at BGO, as much as I talk up what we do with data science and machine learning, I don't want to discount that, but we haven't taken that art part of it out of the process. We're not taking human beings out of the loop, right? This isn't like war games in 1984 where Joshua's going to like nuke Russia because human beings can't control it kind of thing. And so I care about that. On my team, just to show you that I'm not a hypocrite, that I practice what I preach, I have two analysts on my team, both of their first jobs. And that's what I wanted. I think people thought that maybe that wasn't going to be the best model. Maybe I should just hire someone with experience and plug and play sort of thing. And I thought, no, like I've been doing this a long time. I have a good idea for how an economics and research department should be run. These are the people that I want to bring on board. And I think without straining my arm, patting myself on the back, that I've proven that it's the right way to do it. But I also think not just short-term myopic for BGO and what we're doing now, but I think medium to long-term. I think both of them could be the research leaders of the future if they decide that's the career path that they want to be on. And so I don't know how long they'll stay. I don't know when they'll decide they want to try something else or go to graduate school or whatever the case is. But I will tell you, unless somebody absolutely tells me no, I'm going to continue to try to be that person who's not just teaching in the classroom, but also teaching out in the real world and really trying to bring about that next level of researchers. Again, I can't pay back everyone who is a really good teacher and mentor to me along the way. So I will take that responsibility and try to be as good of a teacher, both in the classroom and in the workplace, to that next generation of the future.
That is super encouraging to hear. And I'll reiterate what I said earlier. Every time you speak, it's super exciting. And I really enjoy your perspective. We have one final question for you, which is a question that we ask all of our guests. So if you could snap your fingers and have any change to the industry come true, what would that be?
If I could snap my fingers and change anything, I would want, like, I won't say ubiquity of information, but I'd love clean data sets. Not that we can't do a lot with dirty data sets. We really can, more again than I think is perceived. But there's just sometimes I think, oh, I would love to know X. And there's just like, I'm sure X is a thing. It's just not being tracked and it's not being quantified because for the longest time, especially in this industry, it's been such a relationship business, we didn't think quantifying X was important. And so whether it's the number of days something's been on a market or the number of times a space has been shown or the number of times somebody walked by a building and thought that looks ugly or whatever it is, right? Like, you know, just sometimes it's ridiculous things. And so I just think, oh, if you could just tell me X, I could find a way to incorporate it into a model. But a lot of the time I go looking for X, and it's just, again, I know that phenomenon is happening in the real world, just people aren't really tracking it. And so I think the world will increasingly get there, but I don't know, you know, in some respects, the future's arrived sooner than we thought. And in other respects, I feel like I was promised flying cars like 10 years ago in Back to the Future too, and we still don't have them, so.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for being with us. Before we do sign off, do you want to share with folks how they can find some of your work?
Yeah, I'm not hard to find, as my children will gleefully tell you. It's easy to find me on LinkedIn. You could find the Chief Economist newsletter there. You can also find it through BGO's website, and also, I'm sure, through BGO's site on LinkedIn. It really, I can't emphasize it enough. If you go looking, I'm not hard to find. The last thing I would say is, anyone should feel free to reach out. As you can tell, I have no enthusiasm about what I do. And so I will only begrudgingly answer any questions that I'm kidding, of course. But no, I really, like, I'm always happy to help. So anybody should always feel free to reach out. I'm happy to have a conversation and exchange emails if anyone would ever find it useful. But I'd say LinkedIn is the easiest place to go find what I'm up to these days.
Excellent. Well, Ryan, thank you so much. I think that is all the time we have. I want to just tell you again that we appreciate our listeners tuning in, but take care until the next episode of CRE Exchange.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.